Hi again, everyone. This is Carlos, and what follows is a discussion that I had with Louis Fernando from Emancipated Human for his YouTube show. We had a great talk about child protective services, human nature, the psychology of corruption, and how people profit off of the institutionalization of childhood. As always, I suggest anyone who's even slightly interested in the topic of CPS to get yourself a copy of my book, Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services, which you can find on Amazon and at legallykidnapped.net. I implore anyone who's having to deal with Child Protective Services now to pick that up. And also to reach out to my group, Child Protective Services Victim Support, on Facebook. If you're not subscribed to the podcast feed yet, please do so on iTunes or Stitcher by simply typing in Libertarian Atheist Podcast. And make sure and rate and review this show so that more people hear about it. And on that note, enjoy the show.
So first things first, I'll ask you the first question that comes to mind and that I've been meaning to ask you. What makes you want to join CPS?
So I was actually already libertarian whenever I was in college. I had been following Stefan Molyneux's work, and he had actually kind of turned me towards a guy named Lloyd DeMau, who brought up the childhood origins of war. That's actually what I wrote my main thesis paper on when I was in university. Now, I decided first to actually work do an internship with a place called Child Safe that did interviews for and counseling for children who had been sexually molested. And while I was working there, I found that one of the problems that I was personally having was the fact that I wasn't really able to stop child abuse head on. You know, I wasn't out there. And, you know, when you're 22, 23 years old and you're a guy, you know, jacked up with testosterone and you want to change the world, you know, you find yourself wanting to get into kind of dangerous situations. And Child Protective Services presented me with a few options. One was a job straight getting out of college, which a lot of other companies don't really allow for, as well as knowing the fact that I was going to be able to help kids. And in my first Child Protective Services case, where I walked into a home and right after a drug raid and saw literal fecal matter all over the floor that the children had, they had used the floor as a bathroom because they were told by the drug dealers that they needed to hide drugs, right? When I was presented and put in that situation, that was my first day. And when I saw that, I thought, okay, I really need to work for these people because obviously kids are regularly being abused and CPS is going after those abusive parents. Now, of course, as you can see from my book and the work I've done since then, that wasn't quite the case that I found. What I found after a couple of months working for Child Protective Services was that the majority of people that I was going after were not criminals. They were sometimes ignorant people, maybe ignorant of the law, but not necessarily abusive parents. And when I left the agency as a whole and started doing some activism and seeing the statistics, what I found was that anywhere from 78 to 80% of cases in Child Protective Services where a child is removed is not for physical or sexual abuse, but it's for things like drug use and physical neglect. But in cases like neglect, that can mean something as obtuse as allowing a child to play outside in a park by themselves.
That's extremely stupid, in my opinion. You know, like, I've seen a few cases where that's exactly what happened, and to me it's preposterous that they cannot. I mean, it's not like, you know, you're gonna send them, you know, anyway. It's crazy. So from there, you realize, you open your eyes and said, well, this is not quite working out. And then what?
Yes.
Do you do?
Well, after I left the agency, a lot of things kind of happened in my life all at once. I was becoming disillusioned by working for the state, and I started trying to figure out a way to be able to expose what Child Protective Services is, but without getting myself in too much trouble. You see, at the time I was in Texas and I was married, and I was worried if I had kids sometime soon or something along those lines, then they'd actually come after me. That part of my life changed rather quickly, and I ended up leaving Texas. And when I left Texas, I realized that Child Protective Services, even if I went after them, they didn't have a lot to go after me for. That I didn't have kids that they could go after. All of my relatives were over the age of 18. And I thought, you know, at worst, maybe I can go to jail under some kind of crazy whistleblower law, but I'm willing to take that risk because I couldn't live with knowing that after everything I'd done, after everything I'd seen while working for Child Protective Services, that I couldn't do something to help parents in the future use the information that I learned. I was a little bit naive when I started. I just created some podcast for a show I used to do called the Renegade Variety Hour, where I just kind of talked a little bit about the things I saw. But when I saw how big the network was of people who are being regularly abused by the system, who are regularly being drugged, that the CPS that I saw, the horrific situations where kids who were 7 years old were being put on 7 different psychotropic drugs, that was something that was going on everywhere in the nation, in some cases much worse than what I saw. When I started really taking that in, I thought, there's no way that there isn't someone else like me out there. There's no way that there's not another whistleblower against Child Protective Services. There has to be someone with a conscience to do it. And what I found was that was not the case. So I started something called Child Protective Services Victim Support, which was like a little Facebook group. But that little Facebook group ended up being about 15,000 people.
Wow.
And within that little Facebook group, we didn't do any marketing. We didn't pay for anything. I just talked about it on some shows. But what was really important to me about that Facebook group than some other ones was that I found about 12 people to work with who were advocates across the country, who were answering questions that people had. Because the majority of the people that I end up helping out in a lot of these cases aren't people with a lot of money. Because CPS is usually going for the most impoverished people. It's going for the people who don't have a lot of funds to hire a lawyer. So what I was able to offer to those people is somewhere at least to start. Now, if you're 6 months into your case, it's going to be really difficult for me to be able to even tell you what to do. Because I don't know all the nuances of what's going on. I don't know if you have a lawyer, if you don't have a lawyer. What's going on in your home? And how are the judges seeing it? But what I can tell you, though, is how should you see Child Protective Services as an agency as a whole, which I consider a domestic terrorist organization? And then how do you deal with them if they ever come into your life? And so by having a strong introduction into CPS before you deal with it, you can end up saving yourself from hundreds and not, if not thousands of hours of misery, or possibly the loss of your child for the rest of your life, because you did something stupid, like think that the state had your best interest in mind. And if there's any message I want to really deliver to people, it's that the state doesn't have the best interest in mind. It doesn't. It's not the point of the agency. The point of the agency is the institutionalization of childhood, the institutionalization of the family as a specific set of system, and to control the lives of everyone involved, so that we can become a very predictable, repeatable, inline group of cattle that the state can farm for the future.
Well, that's quite scary when you put it like that.
Well, I did. I kind of found that, you know, so a problem I had with some of the anti-CPS activism out there, namely kind of Alex Jones stuff, was they were saying things like CPS is filled with child molesters and Satanists. And coming from the agency myself, that's not what I saw. I saw state bureaucrats. I saw a lot of people who will say they had the best interest in mind. I'd say a lot of them were actually just there for a paycheck because it was consistent, and they could be called a hero whenever they went home. But I didn't see complete evil, right? Because one of the things about bureaucracies is that they externalize all responsibility so that anything that happens bad can be blamed on someone else, and then they can blame it on someone else. And by externalizing responsibility, you are never truly held accountable. Now, to a stoic like myself now, the worst thing on earth to me is never being able to be held accountable for my actions, because then I can't be happy about any of my actions, because I can't really put that blame on myself either. right? To dedicate your life to that which is outside of control inevitably leads to suffering, right? But that's what the nature of bureaucracies are. It's anti-individualistic, and I'm unsettled by that fact. And so what I decided to do was I thought, you know, what is the history of child protective services as a whole? What is the foundation by which all this started? Was it some kind of conspiracy? And as it turned out, there might be a little bit of truth to people who are making those statements, because CPS started, not the actual agency itself, that wasn't until a little bit later in the 70s, but the idea, the paternalistic state, right, that is ever-growing progressivism as a whole, that all started in the early 1900s, right, with the British aristocracy being afraid of the new immigrants who were coming within the United States. They were afraid that they would have diametrically opposed values, and therefore they needed to set up a state system that prevented things like trade with other countries, that instituted minimum wage laws in order to ensure that black people couldn't cut the pay of white people.
Underbid.
They were setting things up like that. They were also setting up things like public education, which was, I mean, routinely stated as trying to create an underclass who's always trying to get to the upper class, never quite there. Then you have upper class who has a different form of education. So you, again, create that predictability pattern. What they also did, though, to really top it all off, was the creation of the eugenics movement, which was a byproduct of the United States, on top of working with the British government and with British citizens, to create the eugenics movement that Germany's eugenics movement would use later on in the future. Tailored, of course, first by Francis Galton, either the second or third cousin of Charles Darwin, who set out, he was basically under the belief that there was people who needed to be prevented from populating in order to prevent overpopulation of what he considered misfits, deviants, and the mentally retarded.
Wow.
And academics as a whole, and by the way, I do go into this quite a bit of length in my book, Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services. Academics as a whole agreed with the eugenics position. There was 367 colleges, I believe, by 1919 who agreed with the eugenics plan. It was about instilling the period work ethic, instilling the nuclear family, and they used everything from murdering individuals to banning interracial marriage. What many liberals don't seem to understand, or conservatives for that matter, is that marriage licenses were created to prevent interracial marriages. They would actually go, government agents would go to places like North Carolina, South Carolina, where you had blacks already married to whites, and they would separate those because they didn't want miscegenation, which is the creation of mixed race children. Mind you, we're all kind of mixed race. Now, what they also did was forcibly sterilize mass amounts of people within the United States. From the time of 1914 to 1974, 100,000 people were forcibly sterilized within the United States. They did this to Native Americans. For instance, one of the plans, as far as reservations was concerned, was you set up these artificial Indian reservations in areas where you can't really grow any food, right? But you say, look, we're giving you free land, and we're going to give you food stamps. We're going to give you these specific things. And by the way, you're going to have a tyrannical dictator called your tribe leader who's not really connected to your tribe whatsoever. Now, in those situations, if a parent was having too many kids, they would say, if you do not get forcibly sterilized, we are going to not give you any more food. And in the situation in which you are making it illegal to trade, which is what they do in these camps, you're not allowed to trade with people outside of the reservations. That's basically a death sentence. They did this also following the welfare actions that were committed in black ghettos. There was a lot of forcible sterilizations going on in those particular areas. By the way, this isn't crazy conspiracy bullshit. You can find that the government actually has admitted to the eugenics plan, and I believe even Bill Clinton slightly apologized for it, you know, while he was blowing up kids in Bosnia. So this was a large scale plan to remove trade, to prevent miscegenation, right? To prevent unwanted people from coming to the land, create a homogeneous society of well-behaved individuals. Now, it should be no wonder that when people start talking about race realism or worrying about cucks or using these other terms that I hear people not right talking about now, when I get in discussions with these people, I go, you know, the progressives completely agreed with you. And they all the things you don't like now, libertarians who are on the right side who are kind of really afraid of race wars and things, many of the points you agree with led to the government committing certain actions. And many of those actions were in opposition to what they ended up originally instilling, right? So the eugenics plan of implementing things like welfare in order to create a systematic class by giving out welfare payments to individuals who aren't working and not providing anything, you are actually promoting dysgenics rather than eugenics. So everything that the government does has been a catastrophic failure. On like every level, because the thing is, there's so many different unseen costs. And this is why I kind of move slightly away from making a complete New World Order kind of argument, because I believe almost no one knows exactly what's going on. And that's one of the main reasons that freedom is so absolutely essential to solve social problems, right? If someone tells me, how do we deal with child abuse without CPS, I say, how do we deal with drug abuse without the DEA? The DEA has destroyed the way by which we think of drug abuse and understanding drugs as a whole, because it has brought in force and a monopoly on force and taxation, which prevents actual competition from emerging, which then prevents actual understanding and education from coming forward, because everything looks like a nail when you only have a hammer.
Yeah.
Same exact case whenever we're talking about something like Child Protective Services. Everything ends up being you have to use force in every single one of the situations. And there's not a lot of nuance in what is and what is not child abuse, right? So a kid being let out too long and a cop coming by and picking him up and throwing laws against the parents and everything else like that, that's considered neglect. Under the same statute, as possibly the kid's not being actually fed, right? And the mom is out, or mom or the dad or whatever, are leaving their 3-year-old at home by themselves for days on end, right? That's reckless. That is actual reckless endangerment. But you don't see any of this nuance here because you create laws which are in opposition to understanding. It's just authority and force.
I love that. I mean, what you said is very clear, very understandable, and at the same time, it's pretty scary. So let's take it further and talk about foster homes. Where, how do these, draconian bureaucrats get to choose where the kid goes to, and do they get to come back, and do they get medicated? How does that work?
So foster homes are interesting because you can have situations in which a child is removed from a parent, but the rights are not completely removed, right? So if the kid is outside and I grab him and I stick him in a place and I have to do like a placement for a couple of days or something, that's one situation. Then there's, you know, full out placement, which is a little bit different than foster homes. But I would like to kind of go over just for the broader narrative. And of course, again, you can go to my book if you want more kind of a broader outline of what foster homes are as a whole. Just to look at what has been the result of the state getting so involved in the lives of children, especially children who supposedly have been abused. Now, foster kids, and this shouldn't come as too much of a shock to most people, do quite badly in foster homes. A big part of that is, of course, removing a child from a home. So if you think of a kid, he's 5 or so, he has parents that are, you know, okay. He goes to a public school that's all right. He goes to a church regularly. His parents, though, they occasionally smoke some pot. They bust the parents for that. They pull this kid out of his community, out of his church, out of his school, into a home filled with other kids. Now, the foster parent, of course, wants to ensure that the child isn't talking too much, isn't crying too much, is going to sleep. Kids in chaotic, traumatic situations tend to act out because there is no sense of control, right? If you stick me in a cage, it is going to take me a long time to become completely docile and no longer want to get out of the cage. As a result, this child is then brought to a state health doctor, right? And it is in their best interest to ensure that this child shuts up and does what the foster parent wants, right? And with Medicaid, which is the government medical system, the fact that with Medicaid, they can then spend crap tons of money on medication for this child and all of that will be covered promotes reckless spending even more so. As a result of all of this, you have a kid who's acting out, can't sleep for obvious reasons. We'd consider that traumatic related mental issues. They would call it mental illness of a genetic variety. So that would include ADHD, oppositional defiance disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, insomnia. And as a result, you end up with foster kids are three times more likely to be put on psychotropic medications than children who are similarly impoverished or not impoverished. And wow. When you think about three times more likely and the fact that children aged 12 to 19 in the United States, 6% of them are on psychotropic medications already. There's boys are twice as likely to be on ADHD medication than girls, and girls are twice as likely to be on antidepressants, which is essentially speaks more to the idea that the government wants to ensure a homogeneous emotional society of robots because they don't want boys to be too rambunctious and girls to be too emotional. Right, they forcibly give drugs to these kids. If you think about 6% already, and you extrapolate that to possibly 18, and in certain foster homes in certain states, you have 30 to 50% of these kids are on drugs. You start getting in pretty horrendous situations. Now, it's not just drugs, though. They're 7 to 8 times more likely to be physically or sexually abused, not only by foster parents, but by peers as well. Horrifically, they're more likely to have post-traumatic stress disorder than veterans of war, right? There's neurological damage that is occurring to these kids. Now, 50% of them will most likely end up homeless whenever they age out. And again, my book on cites everything. The book's only 110 pages. I think I have 82 citations, which is way more than your average book. And horrifically, they are 6 times more likely to die than if they stayed in an abusive household. And that work was found by the late Senator Nancy Schaefer, who sadly died tragically and was pretty much the only politician who ever went after Child Protective Services as a whole. So this is not just like a small flawed system. This isn't something that needs to be reworked. For every aspect of it is horrendous. This is an agency that needs to be abolished. And I don't see any other way to do that, except most likely for the abolishment of the state as a whole. Because I do not see the progressive paternalistic state that we have suddenly stating, while in the midst of their power, let us no longer control the children. Because what does the state benefit from removing its shackles from the prisoners? For if the child is born into a cage, he thinks that everyone who lives outside of it is insane.
Or a threat.
Yeah.
Because I've experienced that, like, you've probably experienced it too, whenever we try to come with some, enlightening conversation, we're suddenly labeled as extremists or as much as being told that we're the devil and all of that. So I guess this is the perfect segue for the next thing, like the violence inherent in the system and how it hurts everyone. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So when we think about the violence being inherent in the system, that's exactly what's going on with Child Protective Services and any institution which is primarily funded through the threat of force and the use of force as a whole. And I don't find that there's a single person that's necessarily enjoying working for Child Protective Services, right? We can imagine that there's these menacing jackals in the background constantly stating that, oh, isn't it great that these children are being routinely abused? And I don't think that's the case. I think as an institution, as a bureaucracy, it propels itself forward through the conceptual belief that this is the way that it is, and this is the way that it needs to be. That we always need to have a system of statism, of bureaucracy, controlling every single aspect of our life, because one generation after another is continuously being convinced of that at the age of 3, at the age of 4, at the age of 5, depending on how young they're deciding to stick children in public education. So in times when I feel cynical, in times when I feel, and many others feel cynical, about what is the future of mankind as a whole, is it that individuals seemingly just want to be controlled, that they want to live in a status system? You need to remind yourself that we are judging human nature in a time of confinement. Mm-hmm. We are confined to the system as a whole. Now, we can break away in specific parts neurologically, and thankfully many of us have, where we start to think outside of it. But we're still being pushed down on a constant basis, whether it's our want to be able to simply buy something for a cheaper price than what the state is making sure that we have to pay, or the ability to just go get a job. I'm living in the state of California right now. I've talked to many individuals who have had to wait months for licenses to do jobs that they were legally allowed to do in other states or in other countries within 5 minutes. And at the same time, they are taxing them to an absurd amount, even though, even within that system, people are still acting industrially. They're still producing things. You still have a high IQ here, to the point where this state, I believe, even just Silicon Valley would be considered one of the richest nations on earth. Yet California is the most in debt state in the United States. That kind of insanity, right? That is the violence. And it's ever there. It's within every aspect of the system, whether that's within the banking system, of course, which we all know is unholy and illegitimate and a product completely of force, or if it's the military-industrial complex or the drug war complex or all the other complexes that are seemingly increasing day by day. And I honestly do not see how anyone could look at that and think in their mind that if we simply voted in someone new for president, that all of that would go away in a day. For just the people who are simply trying to argue that teachers should have to maybe think a little bit as far as future context is concerned regarding what their retirement plans are, those people get kicked out of, you know, mayor spots or governor spots. I mean, anytime anyone goes even slightly after something like a union, they can get smashed. Now, are the people who are actually within the unions all that helped? Many times, no. But it's just the system in place, and that system exists within their own mind. An anti-individualistic one, a pro-collectivist one, but collectivism plus a tyrannical leader and mindset to boot. And that sticks us in a position where it is possible for us to live longer than ever. But because we spend so many hours working for this system through taxation or any other means, or the amount of time that we spend, that even though our lifespans were going up, our health spans might be declining. Because the amount of time in our own life that we spend stressing about ourselves, about everything going on, about being able to pay our mortgages, about who's going to be the next politician who's going to decide to rule us, about why that other person who believes that different politician is a way worse person, therefore I'm not allowed to talk to him. Once we buy into that narrative, it is inevitably stressful and never truly fulfilling. Because even when you vote in that guy who's good, he's the good guy, in truth, we've never really had an occasion where there was a lot of positive out of any one particular position. And it's a sadness, but there's also, I believe, a hope that comes from knowing that so many people are collectively dropping many of these dogmas. The first is religion, which was one of the most pernicious and destructive forms of thinking, of conceptual framework in order to control individuals that the world has ever seen. Right? Religion, and of course, statism is its own form of religion, although it's a bit of an offshoot. There are actual buildings. There are actual politicians. There is no God. But when it comes to religion, though, that is actually dropping dramatically in westernized countries all across the world. People are leaving churches. That's a very, very positive thing. Now, are there other religions that are a little bit rising? Yes, but not dramatically so. That is starting to teeter down. And I believe as religion drops and the message and the continued messages of freedom and liberation are being discussed in places like the internet, I believe that many of the status concepts that people have will continue to drop more and more as long as we stay principled. As long as we remain fervent in our hatred of the state, not just a position that we just need to reform it. There has to be a hatred of violence, and that only that will help us move forward. Because if we continue to convince ourselves that if we get the right guy in, that something positive is going to happen. Well, they're going to. That allows them to keep this show going, and it allows them the rationalization and motive to propel forward. For just one more law will make us free.
That is actually so funny. One more law will make us free. Completely the opposite of reality. Now, I do have something to say. I think that as anarchists, there's got to be like you mentioned, a hate towards the system, towards the state. But I think that even more important than hate towards the state, there's got to be a love for what we want to see. So we actually put a lot of energy into what we want to create and not just spending all our attention towards dismantling something. I mean, does that make sense to you?
I absolutely agree with you. Yeah. Trust me, you're not going to have me disagreeing about why love is so important in our lives and ways and trying to understand best ways to communicate, to understand and have that capacity for love and to maintain love either in relationships or for many people as a whole. You know, there's one love isn't better than another love. You know, there's the end, and it is love that will be able to kind of carry us forward. It's unfortunate that term is so either bastardized or undermined on such a constant basis. I would certainly state that in cases of men who simply state you're weak or you're gay for talking about love, that is a really atrocious and horrendous type of a situation that men have decided to put themselves into. And people who also use the words love to mean abuse in other situations also abuse the term as well by stating that whenever I hit my child, I do it out of love. Whenever I hit my partner, I do it out of love. Whenever I hit my dog, I do it out of love. And in all these situations, of course, you're acting in contradiction to the term itself. So in understanding the honesty and virtue and integrity that is necessary to actually attain and to give love, is a large aspect in what can allow us to be able to move towards at least some kind of freedom. Because if there isn't something to live for, then why try and even be free?
Exactly. That's exactly the point, the message that I try to just push to people, because that's the love for what we want, I think, should be way bigger than the hate towards the state. Because I think we're able to, this is going to go on its own accord as we gain gain more awareness. So it's going to go away. We're going to work on it. Now, what do we want to build? And that's the important part, I think, as far as, you know, what we want to build on that's going to create and privatize, I guess, all the bureaucracy that's taking place here. How can we make it better? How can we help ourselves and those around us? How can we make changes that are truly empowering for everybody that is involved there? So, I mean, this conversation is extremely powerful, and there's a lot of great, juicy information here. Any plugins or anything that we missed that you think you want to touch?
I mean, I'm sure I have 1,000 other things in my notes that we could discuss, but if people want to know more about Child Protective Services, I can say I literally wrote a book on it, and you can find it at legallykidnapped.net. It's called Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services. You can also find my work, as far as my podcast is concerned, by just typing in Libertarian Atheist on either Stitcher or whatever podcast app you use. Or you can go to the thinkaboutnow.com website, which has many of my blogs. Myself and MK Lords both write on that. She's also on the podcast as well. And yeah, that'll certainly get you there. As far as YouTube is concerned, I'm not on it as much as I'd like to be. But just time management wise, it always seems that podcasts are a little bit easier to get out than trying to ensure that everyone's video capabilities are right. And God knows, with how obnoxious I am with editing, video just drives me nuts. So that's about it, man. Thank you so much for having me on, though. This is a great conversation. And yeah, let's certainly do it again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And guys, if you really like this, share it and try to find his book. I think it's pretty cheap. I purchased it like a year ago for, how much was it? Like $3?
Yeah, it would have been $3 in the past. I think it's like $5 now. Because inflation, and also because $5, I think, for introduction to law and family court, an introduction to the entire history of CPS, what it is, what I saw. Don't think I'm asking for too much. I believe the paperback version is like $9 or $10, and you get a full paperback, beautiful copy. I think I'm going to take fucking credit for that one. I was a bestseller on Amazon with that for a bit. I think we knocked out about 12,000 copies in the first like 3 days. So
that's remarkable.
Glad to be in that position, and I want to continue to move forward and get more people to get that book, because honestly, it's helped out so many people. What really strikes the meaning for me is the people who send me messages and say, hey, I used your book and CPS came into my life, and they were out of my life within about 72 hours.
That is so amazing.
When you fucking hear that, I mean, you can't really beat that, can you? Yeah. No.
That feeling is amazing.
That is social work. And yeah. And by the way, for anyone who's giving me crap for selling a book, I'm going to tell you that it costs a lot of money to do things in life. So.
I mean, who in their right mind, who have a brain, will give you grief for selling a book, dude? I mean,
people who I believe have never worked for themselves and assume that bosses are greedy bastards who just love money and hate paying everyone.
That's silly.
Yeah, that's the socialist mindset. But anyway, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, man.
We have Carlos Morales here with us. He's amazing, as you noticed. And please find him on Facebook. He's there also pretty much all the time. He works from home, so he gets to keep his tabs open on Facebook too, just like me. This is Luis Fernando Mises with Emancipated Human. Remember to subscribe if you like this, share it as well. And if you have any questions, any comments, find him or me, or just put it down below in the comment section. Anything else, just let us know. And peace, love, and anarchy. Thank you so much.